From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. The Justice Department's critique of the Baltimore Police Department accused city police of systematically under-investigating reports of sexual assault, failing to collect evidence, interview witnesses, or test forensic evidence. We talked to an advocate for survivors of sexual abuse about what police misunderstand about victims of trauma and what changes the city should make.
To change the policing culture around gender and around misogyny is going to take ongoing training and retraining, that bias against women or racial bias is a learned behavior.
Then we talked to a journalist and filmmaker who traveled the country asking people about a highly controversial term, the N-word. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. In its investigation of Baltimore police, the U.S. Justice Department documented a pattern of discriminatory policing, with African-American residents facing disproportionate stops, searches, and arrests. In addition, the department concluded that the Baltimore Police Department, quote, seriously and systematically under-investigates reports of sexual assault, end quote. The report noted that the police department fails to pursue investigations of sexual assaults by interviewing witnesses or gathering evidence, that officers fail to include their notes in case files, and that detectives fail to request lab testing of rape kits and other forensic evidence. The police and justice departments are now crafting a court-enforceable consent decree to hold the city accountable for reforms. They're hearing from citizens what those reforms should be. With us to discuss the findings of the Justice Department and what the consent decree could mean for victims of sexual assault is Jacqueline Robarge. Jacqueline Robarge is executive director and founder of Power Inside, a harm reduction and human rights organization in Baltimore. Power Inside serves women and girls who are survivors of abuse and oppression. The nonprofit offers group counseling, reentry services for those returning from incarceration, leadership development, and other services. Welcome to On the Record.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to see you.
Yeah.
What was your reaction to the Department of Justice report?
I guess I had a lot of reactions, a feeling of vindication for some of the survivors who have had experiences trying to report sexual assaults, or feeling lost or confused, never having been followed up with by the police after reporting a sexual assault. Also a great deal of sadness, because between the time that police department was aware that these problems existed and they continued to persist, that many more survivors have been harmed. And in addition to that, we still have, hundreds, if not thousands, of survivors out there who have not received access to justice or the services of the police department.
When you say that the police department knew for a long time and didn't make changes, are you referring to the investigation that Justin Fenton of the Baltimore Sun did in 2010, revealing that police were classifying rape cases as unfounded, meaning that they did not believe a crime occurred, 5 times the national average of finding cases unfounded?
That's part of it, Sheila. The second part of it is, after that came out, there was a process of reforms that were created. The SART was one of them.
SART, Sexual Assault Response Team.
Correct. And some communications with the community and some media campaigns that were intended to reach survivors who may have tried to report a rape but did not get proper services, or they may have been unfounded. Throughout 2010 to 2012, Power Inside and other organizations were communicating with the Baltimore City Police Department that the reforms were not working, that certain survivors were not being treated well by the police, they reports were not even taken at all. Some women reported rapes who were injured, who were hospitalized after a rape, and the police department humiliated them, refused to take reports, refused to follow up when they did take reports. And so they were well aware in 2011 that the reforms were not taking hold and were particularly not reaching homeless women, addicted women, women who are involved in the sex trade. Those are women that people, quite frankly, believe can't be raped. They're not rapeable. And so when they report a rape, the police readily dismiss the assaults against them.
If I heard you correctly, you said that in 2010, 2011, 2012, you were telling the police that problems still existed. What happened in 2012?
I don't have the exact timeline, but actually if you date back when organizations that represent vulnerable women were trying to get the attention of the city about what was happening on the streets to vulnerable women, it goes back for as long as our program has been in existence, which is 2001. There was a set of very violent serial killings of women who were homeless on the street that involved sexual assaults well prior to 2010. And so those serial killings started a lot of our constant advocacy about the interrelationship between targeting vulnerable women, either for sexual assault, homicide, or other types of assault, and continued to this day. So each incident, each homicide, each complaint that we tried to facilitate came with its own story. So we had a community event where the head of sex crimes was in attendance, along with many police officers. We had the mayor's office on criminal justice out and the head of sex crimes out to our office, and they heard a story from a survivor who had been raped and ran into a police station injured and her clothes torn, and she was threatened to be arrested if she didn't leave the police station. She, at that time, this survivor told the head of sex crimes that she also was being sexually exploited by police officers, meaning the police said, if you don't have sex with me, I'll arrest you. And so that's a form of sexual assault. And bringing these complaints, it was hard to get any action. Sometimes we were told survivors need to come forward themselves, or there's nothing they could do, or they disciplined an officer by moving him from one district to another. But it wasn't until we saw the validation in the Department of Justice findings that this was a structural, systemic issue. I mean, we had our suspicions, but this is now something that the entire world knows, that the Baltimore City Police Department does not afford certain women their basic human rights.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Jacqueline Robarge, Executive Director of Power Inside. We're talking about findings of the Justice Department about how the Baltimore Police handles or doesn't handle complaints of sexual assault. The Department of Justice report noted that often if a victim didn't come forward immediately, detectives asked victims why they waited to file a report. What does that line of questioning tell you that police misunderstand about victims of assault and abuse?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different responses to trauma, and depending on how someone copes with the trauma, either by shutting down, by numbing or self-medicating, or acting out in anger and rage about the violence that's been perpetrated against them, that those reactions can be misinterpreted or even biased. So, for example, if a woman doesn't come forward right away, or she decides to immediately take a shower or do something to kind of protect and make herself feel safe, if a police officer doesn't have proper training and understanding of trauma, they may misinterpret that as something that invalidates the violence that's been perpetrated against them.
You're listening to On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about sexual assault in Baltimore and the Department of Justice's finding that the Baltimore police failed to investigate it seriously. Jacqueline Robarge of Power Inside is here. Power Inside and other groups invited survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence to a town hall last month. One of the questions posed was, what does police supporting and believing survivors look like? Jacqueline, let me turn that on you. How would you answer that question?
We asked that question because we all know that universally survivors want to be treated with respect, but we're trying to get at the actual qualities or behaviors of what respect means to them. And so, you know, it was interesting what came out of that particular town hall and the interviews and focus groups that we did with our Power Inside members is that respect is not only treatment that includes kindness and compassion and listening. It also is a value system that they matter. And that survivors matter enough to hold police accountable, to properly train them to interact with survivors. And I thought that was an interesting outcome of the question because we didn't ask them for specific policy recommendations. But when we said, what does it look like? They included things that were readily translated into policy.
Like
they want police officers to adequately understand what trauma looks like so that they can interact appropriately with survivors. They want to be told all of their options, the range of their options. One survivor said, I want to know what you can do, not what you can't do. And they also wanted accountability. They said, we want accountability, not slaps on the wrist. And so they saw that the treatment that survivors of police brutality, survivors of sexual misconduct, and misconduct in general are receiving, the police aren't being held accountable for that. And that is a sign of disrespect to the people that have suffered that.
So how would you envision that being written into a consent decree?
You know, we've struggled with this a lot. I mean, we, meaning at Power Inside, we're struggling with trying to craft recommendations to provide to the Department of Justice that really can speak to just how dramatically our entire culture needs to change. So the U.S. culture of policing is in violation of international human rights. And so to try and reduce that down into bite-sized pieces into a federal consent decree is very difficult. We have given the Department of Justice the breadth of outcomes we would like to see and are very hopeful that they will try and, in the spirit of the outcomes desired, craft the recommendations accordingly. Having said that, we want more training and we want appropriate, local, specific, and transparent training. We want to know who's providing the training. We would prefer local community-based organizations who have the cultural and community knowledge to do so. We want to have the desired outcomes of the training to be transparent so that we know what are the goals that they're working toward. And we also want to have regular and ongoing training because the gender bias is very culturally embedded in our society, but within the police department, it's also embedded culturally. And to change the policing culture around gender and around misogyny is going to take ongoing training and retraining. That bias against women or racial bias is a learned behavior. And so how are we going to go about helping them unlearn? And it's not going to be one section in the academy training and then they're done and they're good to go. I think one of the other recommendations that I think was important is that survivors want police officers who are a threat to the community, a threat to children, a threat to women, to be off the street. And that includes police officers who have committed sex crimes or domestic violence in their personal lives, to not be allowed to police the community, because they are the ones responsible for helping to keep women safe.
And the victims whom you mentioned a few minutes ago with additional vulnerabilities, homeless women, mm-hmm. sex workers, also transgender women, are there particular elements in the consent decree that you think are needed to address their vulnerabilities?
I think there needs to be multiple avenues for reporting sex crimes against them, because many of the vulnerable populations are also criminalized populations through prostitution laws, through the criminalization of homelessness or drug addiction, or the ways that people with mental illness often acquire a criminal background. They are more at risk for rearrest, and they're also more wary of the police. And so it may be difficult for those people to report sexual misconduct by the police, and it may be more difficult for them to report a sexual assault against them. So other avenues for how to report. And then for those groups, we need to have some checks and balances that if something goes wrong and they need to do a complaint, that there is an independent body that they could take a complaint to. Because if you are raped by a police officer, it's extremely hard to go to the police and say, "This happened to me," and have you be someone who's already sexually exploited or vulnerable in some way or have a criminal background. And so because they are rarely, if ever, believed that something happened at all, as evidenced by stories that we read in the findings of repeated incidents over years of police officers who have sexually exploited vulnerable women in their police car in plain sight of community members calling repeatedly to Metro Crime Stoppers.
A lot to think about. Thank you for walking us through it. Jacqueline Robarge is executive director and founder of Power Inside, an organization in Baltimore that serves women and girls who are survivors of abuse and oppression. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
A break now on The Record. I'm Sheila Cast.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're devoting the rest of the show to a film playing locally this weekend as part of the Baltimore Black International Film Festival. The film is called Journey to the Bottom of the N-Word. Filmmaker Frank Harris III, a journalism professor at Southern Connecticut State University, joins us by phone to explain what exactly that journey entails. Frank Harris, welcome to On the Record.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Frank Harris, let's start with a short clip from the trailer for your film. Listeners, a word of warning. The N-word is used several times in its entirety in this clip. And in fact, Frank Harris may use it during this interview. Here's the clip.
I don't like the word nigger. I never liked the word nigger.
I mean, it was a word that was spawned out of hate, which is not good, so it shouldn't really be used by anybody. But I feel like if it's going to be used, everybody should be able to use it. I personally don't.
That answer?
Well, you know, sometimes if I'm with my friends, I'll be like, yo, what's up, nigga? Pass me that joint.
It's common. It's normal to me.
So you use it a lot?
Yes, every day.
I don't think it's right for people to look down on themselves like that.
Those are a few of the voices from Journey to the Bottom of the N-Word by filmmaker Frank Harris III. Frank Harris, you've made a movie about an extremely inflammatory word. What led you to do it?
I was teaching a course that I created called Race in the News, and one of the assignments had the students go look at the archives of old newspapers to find out how people were identified. And a lot of my students came back and they were really expressing shock that the word Negro was being found in old newspapers. And I had to inform them that this was a respectable word at one point in time. And it got me thinking about the many references in which Americans of Black African descent have been identified as. And, of course, there was the N-word, spelled with an E-R at the end and an A at the end. And one of the things that I started to explore was, when did this word first start becoming used prevalently in America? And newspapers were the best source for that. So that's one part of the research. And then I wanted to talk to people across the country, all kinds of people, Black, white, Asian, Hispanic, everybody of different ages, to kind of get an idea of what their experience with the word is. What was their first memory of the word? What do they think about its use?
What would you say that you learned from all those conversations?
Well, I was frequently surprised and sometimes shocked by what stories that they had to tell. One of the things that I experienced when I was first starting to do this, I was in Spartanburg, South Carolina. I just decided I'm going to get off at the next stop and I'm going to talk to the first person that I see. And one of the first persons was a gun and pawn shop. And I went in there and there was a old white man there. Behind him was this rack of guns. And I walked in and I said, "Hey, my name is Frank Harris. I'm interviewing people about the N-word." I asked what his experience was with the word, and he said, "Well, I was born with everybody I know you. I didn't know nobody didn't use it." And I said, "Well, do you still use it?" And he says, "No, sir, I'm a born-again Christian. I believe God created everybody equal." And I wasn't expecting that from this man. And he went on to talk about the N-word and his experience and so on. It just led me to really want to get the many different experiences that people had. There's the music part of it. There's so many different experiences to it, and it's something that I consider to be one of the most important projects that I've done in my life.
Do you think the use of the word is different if it has an A at the end rather than an ER?
I personally don't think it's different, and one of the things that I explore in the film is that thought that somehow rap music or hip-hop music created the A at the end, and that makes it different. And what I show in the film is documentation from old newspapers in which the N-I-G-G-A or N-I-G-G-U-A, in addition to the E-R at the end, was used prominently long, long, long before rap music, hip-hop music came along.
You pointed out some ways that the word has been used through history. Interviewing people in the 21st century, did you find racial differences, a difference in how white people and Black people and perhaps other races use the word?
I don't want to say everybody uses the word, but they are using it because they hear it in music. I had a white guy tell me he sings along to the music. He's kind of embarrassed to say it. So in terms of the difference, I think many whites have bought into, well, if they say it with an A, it's okay. But many do not say it around Black people. But there was one young man from Mississippi who was saying he can accept the word being used by other Black people and maybe others who are people of color, but he cannot accept it being used from a white person. He said it comes with too much. On the other hand, there's other Blacks who have said that they would accept it depending upon the context.
Did you pick up generational differences?
One of the things that I kept hearing from older Blacks was that they were called it so much in the South sometimes. I had one artist in New Haven who grew up in Georgia. He said he was called it so much as a kid that he thought it was his name, and he answered to it. Most of the younger Black people that I talked to said they'd never been called that word by a white person in a hostile kind of way. And so they see that as something in the past. On the other hand, I had an older Black person in Virginia say the same thing. I'm not trying to convert people, but my purpose of the film was really to consider the N-word as a cigarette and consider this film as your Surgeon General. So I'm presenting you the information indicating the roots of the N-word and what it means, where it came from, and how it has affected people and still continues to affect people. But then it's up to the viewer to decide whether that person wants to stop, start, or never, you know, never even pick it up.
Thank you for talking to us.
Sure.
Southern Connecticut State University journalism professor Frank Harris III, his film, Journey to the Bottom of the N-Word, will air at the Baltimore Black International Film Festival tomorrow afternoon at 4 p.m. at the Murphy Fine Arts Center on the campus of Morgan State University. We have more information at WYPR.org on the record page. Also, a link to Harris's website, The N-Word Project. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Kast. Glad you're listening.